Psalms 90. Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations, before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn man back into dust and say, "Return, O children of men," for 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. You have swept them away like a flood, they fall asleep. In the morning they are like grass which sprouts anew. In the morning it flourishes and sprouts anew, toward evening it fades and withers away. For you have been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we have been dismayed. You have placed our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all your days have declined in your fury. We have finished our years like a sigh. As the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years. Yet their pride is but labor and sorrow. For soon it is gone, and we fly away. Who understands the power of your anger and your fury according to the fear that is due you? So teach us to number our days, that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. Do return, O Lord, how long will it be? And be sorry for your servants, O satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness, that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days you have afflicted us, and the years we have seen evil. Let your work appear to your servants, and your majesty to your children. Let the favor of the Lord our God be upon us, and confirm for us the work of our hands. Yes, confirm the work of our hands.
James 4. What is the source of quarrels and conflicts among you? Is not the source your pleasures that wage war in your members? You lust and do not have, so you commit murder. You are envious and cannot attain, so you fight and quarrel. You do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, so that you may spend it on your pleasures. You adulteresses, do you not know that friendship with the world is hostility toward God? Therefore, whoever wishes to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think that Scripture speaks to no purpose? He jealously desires the Spirit which he has made to dwell in us. But he gives a greater grace. Therefore it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Submit therefore to God. Resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be miserable, and mourn, and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning, and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and he will exalt you. Do not speak against one another, brethren. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you are not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. There is only one lawgiver and one judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. But who are you to who judge your neighbor? Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. These are God's words.
I propose this morning to introduce this book, and I'll explain a little bit about that as we move on. Verses 1 through 3. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What advantage does man have in all his labor which he labors under the sun? You may be seated. I have produced and have available for you an outline of the message this morning. There are copies back on the table where the bulletins are found. For 50 years or so, I've been preoccupied and intrigued by this book of Ecclesiastes. I was first introduced to it by J.I. Packer, has a wonderful treatment of this book in his volume, Knowing God, chapter 10, I believe, God's Wisdom and Ours. Since reading Packer's treatment, I've studied the book many times and taught it three or four times in churches. Must apologize to old timers here. I've taught this book once before and within Legacy Baptist Church. But the personnel at that time were largely different than they are now. So to those who were here before, my apologies. It was not too repetitious, but if you're like me, this book is always intriguing and always fruitful. I'm uncertain whether this topic is worthwhile for our Sunday morning treatment. So I'm proposing to introduce the book today and solicit your opinion about it. If you think it's good for Sunday morning, then I would propose to continue with it in any opportunity I have to be in the pulpit. If not, we could change it to Sunday evening or some other time. Ecclesiastes seems to represent a quest for answers. I suggest there are two questions which make up this quest. In a world seemingly governed by transience, futility, aimlessness, and frustration, how is man to know what is most conducive to his own permanent happiness, satisfaction, and fulfillment? In other words, what can man know about how he is to live his life in this world? Also in such a world, number two, how is man to know what God is up to in the way God has ordered this world? Seems to be a world of transience, futility, aimlessness, and frustration, does it not? I suggest that the book of Ecclesiastes is largely about knowing, human knowing. The Hebrew verb yada, to know, occurs about 40 times in the book. That suggests this is a major theme. The study of epistemology, the theory of knowing, may sound like a very theoretical thing, but for the author of Ecclesiastes, it was a very practical thing. How are humans to live and order their lives in the midst of such a world as we find ourselves? Seems to be disorderly, full of unpredictability, frustration, injustice, and downright wickedness. Why is the world like that, and how are we to get along in it? The world in which humans must make their way is one in which it's difficult to answer this question. What course of action and attitude is likely to be the most beneficial or advantageous to us? This is the question that the author is asking in verse 3. What advantage does man have in all his labor in which he labors under the sun? Let's start with verse 1, which introduces the author. Strictly speaking, the book of Ecclesiastes is anonymous. That is, there is no author named with a proper name. First verse says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. The term the preacher is a Hebrew word meaning one who gathers. It's been suggested this means one who gathers a congregation, such as a body and an assembly to teach or preach, hence the title preacher, Or perhaps he gathers thoughts of wisdom, as the end of the book indicates. The Hebrew term, the preacher has no definite article. It's not the preacher, but it's just Koheleth. Koheleth, Q-O-L-E-T-H. Q-O-H-E-L-E-T-H, Koheleth. That's the only name given to the author. What is said about him, or by himself, in verse 1, and also in verses 12 and 16 of this chapter, have suggested to many of this, it must be Solomon, the son of David, who became king after David. This assignment of authorship to Solomon has traditionally been received as the correct understanding, often as is assumed by expositors and preachers and many interpreters of the past as they approach the book. For example, the Geneva Bible, published 1560. Geneva Bible is probably the first study Bible ever produced. Produced by the English exiles in Geneva, Switzerland, during the time of Queen Mary, Bloody Mary, while she was persecuting believers in England. The Geneva Bible, in its notes, assumes that Solomon was the author. Commentators such as Matthew Poole and Matthew Henry also understand Solomon to have been the author. However, we should be aware that modern scholars have sometimes disputed Solomonic authorship. Edward J. Young, a quite conservative Old Testament scholar, indicates that more recently Solomonic authorship, quote, is rejected by most Orthodox Protestant scholars. Young mentioned several factors in reaching this conclusion. One, the name Solomon does not appear in the book anywhere. No explicit claim is made that Solomon authored this book. Two, all the writings that Solomon wrote bear his name in their titles, such as Song of Solomon, Proverbs of Solomon, even more obscure writings of Solomon, such as Psalm 72 and Psalm 127, have his name attached to them. Young argues the mention of David as the successor, or as preceding this author, son of David, king of Jerusalem, is not intended to identify Solomon as the author of the book. Rather, the writer made use of a literary device of a Solomonic personage, which is my term, to represent the kind of mind that would come to the type of conclusions found in this book. Edward J. Young says, wisdom is here represented as embodied in a person. That person is Solomon. Hence, it is in ideal sense that Solomon is introduced, so the author is not guilty of a literary deception. Other considerations also have led some modern scholars to reject Solomon as the author. There are, however, many recent modern Old Testament scholars who maintain Solomonic authorship. I'm not willing to dispute that. Perhaps in light of such disagreement among even conservative scholars, it would be best to say this matter is an open question. We leave the authorship of Ecclesiastes an open question. In my presentations, I will simply refer to the author as Koheleth, which is the only name given to him in the book, Koheleth. The theme of the book is given in verse 2. It's what I call futility. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. The word vanity translates the Hebrew word hebel. In English, H-E-B-E-L. It's translated in the King James Version as vanity, and most English versions since then. Probably most of the ones that we use vanity. New King James Version, New American Standard, ESV, and LSB all translate the term vanity. I think the translators of the New King James Version are probably on the right track when they suggest that the word takes on different nuances of meaning in the book. They list four such nuances: absurdity, frustration, futility, nonsense. They're suggesting a different context where the word is used can have a little different coloring, can refer to frustration, can refer to futility, can refer to something that seems absurd or just doesn't make any sense at all. Other scholars note that the word hebel literally means a vapor, a breath, and emphasize the quality of transience as representing the essence of this thought. Like when you go outside on a chilly winter morning, you breathe out, you see some of your breath in the form of vapor, but disappears immediately. That's what life is, a vapor. So I think that the idea of transience also has to be added to the list. So there are four or five different nuances the word can carry in the book of Ecclesiastes. You have to determine its meaning in every context in which it's used. One thing it probably does not mean is meaningless. The New International Version translates the word as meaningless all the way through. Would a biblical writer really be saying everything is meaningless? I don't think so. I don't think that's the intent of Koheleth either. The point seems to be not that things have no meaning, but there is great difficulty in discerning that meaning. Meaning of things is not entirely accessible to humans. Humans cannot get to the meaning of things in their own limited knowledge and wisdom. In Koheleth's argument, I think he's assuming that the meaning of things is given by God. God hasn't told us, however, the meaning of everything. So we have to be content with what we have. The central question of Ecclesiastes is presented in verse 3. What advantage does man have in all his labor in which he labors under the sun? Several points of examination under this verse are worthy of our attention. I'm suggesting first that this question forms the central issue of the entire book. Here is the key to Koheleth's thought. He wants to know, what advantage does man have in all his labor in which he labors under the sun? I think it's a genuine question. It's not a rhetorical question. It's not a rhetorical flourish. Koheleth wants information. How am I to live my life in the midst of a world that seems governed by frustration and happenstance and injustice? He wants to know about himself, about the world, about God's purposes, about the ultimate good for human beings. His question centers on the issue of what is the benefit of man's endeavors in this world. Do those efforts provide any clue to the ultimate meaning of things? This interest of Koheleth seems to suggest, again, that the book is really about knowledge. or the lack of knowledge, or the difficulty of obtaining knowledge, true knowledge about our world. How can humans know what constitutes the good life? That seems to be the central issue. There's an important Hebrew word again in this verse, translated in the version I'm reading, advantage. That's the Hebrew word yithron. It means gain or profit. What is the gain, the profit, the advantage, the benefit of all our labors in this world? That's the question he's asking. I think that word advantage should be understood in a broad sense, not narrowly as in profit, meaning surplus value economically. The question most broadly considered seems to be that of the good which humans ought to be pursuing. What is that good? I think also the term labor should likewise be understood in the broadest way. What advantage does man have in all his labor in which he labors under the sun? I think it's not just life-sustaining or gainful employment. It is all of our effort, our endeavor, our striving, our working, seeking. Another characteristic term of Goeth in Ecclesiastes occurs at the end of verse 3, under the sun. I suggest that this term should also be interpreted broadly. I suggest that as a provisional, theoretical, deliberately adopted perspective for viewing and evaluating human life and endeavor. In other words, Goeth, the thinker, is a God-centered man, but he wants to discern whether human effort on its own can discover what is worthwhile in this life under the sun. Under the sun means something like earthbound, I would suggest. An earthbound perspective or vantage point for observing and evaluating earthly developments. We get any advance of knowledge, we gain any wisdom from this earthbound perspective. Throughout the book, he's going to be using this term, especially in the first half of the book. Under the sun means within our earthly sphere of human activity. I suggest that Coelho adopted the concept of a self-limiting viewpoint to determine whether earthly affairs have a self-explanatory power. I believe this under-the-sun approach does not represent Coelho's ultimate epistemology or theory of knowledge, just an approach he adopted for the sake of argument in this book. Coelho himself held to a transcendent outlook, indicated by his frequent mention of God. He mentioned God first in verse 13 of this first chapter. Grievous endeavor which God has given to the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. So it's a God-saturated book. God is mentioned almost every chapter. So he's not considering life without God. He's considering, can humans know merely from the earthly human sphere what is good for them? The answer will be negative. One scholar says Coelho uses the phrase to affirm the limitations of his inquiry. This language is utilized to declare that earthbound human efforts to discern in detail the purposes of God and the anomalies, injustices, and frustrations of everyday life themselves end up in frustration and futility. In other words, the search for meaning in this world is also futile. It's vain. It accomplishes nothing. because we have to take into account God himself. It seems to me that Kohelet wants to discern in detail the purposes of God and the anomalies of human life in this world. But those purposes of God are not open to human investigation. They're inscrutable. All efforts to grasp them are vanity, like the effort to grasp the wind. In order for humans to understand the purposes of God, he has to reveal the purposes of his heart to them, which he has done on occasion and in general ways, but not in detail. We don't know why specific things happen in this world. We don't know how it all fits together. I think what Kohelet wants to know is how it all comes together in the mind of God. But we don't have access to the mind of God, and even if he told us, we couldn't understand, because his mind is infinite and we're finite. The ultimate question for the author of Ecclesiastes is this: in what does ultimate good for man, all his toil, consist? Ultimate good was understood as profit, advantage, gain, benefit. And his toil is labor, expenditure, energy, striving, effort. I think this question dominates the book, and it's the question he begins with in verse 3. Man's labor is the effort in view here in verse 1 and 2. That labor includes other tasks than maintaining one's physical life in the world. According to chapter 1, verse 13, 3, chapter 3, 10 and 11, 8, 17, it's part of man's labor to seek to find out what the divine mind is up to in the events of earth. Verse 13 here, he says, I gave my heart to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that God, all that has been done in heaven, the grievous endeavor which God has given to the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He suggests that this is an endeavor, an effort, which God has assigned to men to figure out what's going on. But it's grievous for us because we can't solve it on our own. So ultimately there's meaning involved. What's the meaning of this, of our life in this world? What's the meaning of these events that puzzle us? I think the ultimate answer which he's going to give is enjoy life while fearing God. Fear God and enjoy your life as fully as you can. The pragmatic answer then is the same as the pragmatic answer now. We have fuller revelation than Old Testament saints had, especially if it's the time of Solomon around 1900 BC. We have the actual accomplishment of redemption behind us, and including the resurrection of Christ, which answers many of Kohelet's questions. But the issues of living are largely the same as we live our lives day to day. We have the same questions that Kohelet had, and the same provisional answers are with us today. As redeemed people, we are to enjoy life and fear God, leaving the results and final outcome to him. I found a very helpful practice that John Calvin has in his commentaries as At the beginning of his treatment of any given book, he lays out what he calls the argument. So within a few pages, he'll trace the argument of that book or the Bible, or that piece of literature. I propose to look at the argument of Ecclesiastes very briefly by looking at some texts. We won't look at all these. We don't have time this morning. There are at least four texts in which Kohelet seems to lay out his aim for the project embodied in this book. I call these the programmatic texts. These texts are usually written in the first person singular, I, and they express an endeavor which is undertaken, which is the quest of the book. These texts imply or explicitly state it's God's arrangement of things as the ultimate object of his attempt to understand. And thirdly, he reaches the negative conclusion that humans are unable to attain such knowledge on their own from the under-the-sun perspective. Early programmatic texts include chapter 1, verses 13 and 14, which we'll consider more fully the next time we meet if we deal with this book. I gave my heart to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that has been done under heaven. It is a grievous endeavor which God has given to the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. Here, Kohelet gives an early intimation of his own aims and purposes. This text suggests that the unhappy business is the pursuit of this kind of wisdom itself. Final expression of verse 13 could be translated to be troubled with, to occupy themselves with, or to be troubled with. Makes it seem as if God himself, who has set such an aim or goal or desire in the hearts of humans, but to trouble someone, sometimes called grievous, as in the LSB. The phrase "is done," "has been done under heaven," or "is done," could also be translated, "God has done. He has done." That alerts to part of what Kohelet has in view. He wants to know what God himself is up to in this earthly sphere. His inquiry, I think, is into the plans and purposes of God which are carried out on this earth under heaven. That phrase, "under heaven," is a little different than "under the sun." Could mean under heaven's direction, under God's direction. The conclusion he reaches in verse 14, "I've seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and striving after wind." The phrase "under heaven" is used in verse 13. "Under the sun" in verse 14. I think there's a slight difference between those two. But he concludes, "all is vanity and striving after wind." Humans can't figure out what God is up to, as hard as they might try. Chapter 3, verses 1 through 15 is also another programmatic text. This is one of the best known passages of Ecclesiastes, this poem about the appropriate time for everything. Time to give birth, the time to die, and so forth. Verses 1 through 8. After that, he comes to the point again, verse 9. What advantage is there to the worker from that in which he labors? have seen the endeavor which God has given to the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. Once again, it seems to be that endeavor is to figure out what God is doing. Verse 13, he set eternity in men's hearts. Verse 11, he set eternity in men's hearts. Yet so the man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. Their call becomes explicit. It's finding out the work that God has done. That's his concern. And he makes it pointedly the case in that verse. Men cannot find out what God has done. That which man would like to know, he cannot know. Verse 13, 14, chapter 7 is another programmatic text. It's not written in the first person, but in the third person. Here he, or second person. It says, see the work of God, consider the work of God, who is able to straighten what he has bent. In the day when there is good, be of good cheer. But in the day when there is evil, see, God has made the one as well as the other. So the man will not find out anything that will be done after him. Here I think he's inviting the reader to join him in this quest. Consider the work of God. Probably the central programmatic text is found toward the end of chapter 7. Starting verse 23. I test all this with wisdom. I said I will be wise, but it was far from me. What has been is far away and exceeding deep. Who can find it? I turn my heart to know and explore and to seek wisdom and explanation and to know the wickedness and foolishness and the simple-minded folly of madness. Here's the word explanation, verse 25. I want to know, to explore, and seek wisdom and an explanation. At that point, the ESV translates that word scheme of things, which I like as a translation. I believe the original American Standard Version uses explanation of things, or the reason of things. The word of things is added by translators to make it clear what's being referred to there. But here he seems to add clarity to his program. I turn my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom and the scheme of things and to know the wickedness of folly and the foolishness that is madness. That's the ESV rendering. I think the central aim of Ecclesiastes is expressed in this paragraph. Seeking to know the scheme of things, how God orders the universe and life on planet Earth so that it all hangs together, all works out for his purposes and his glory. This is the ultimate object of Coelho's curiosity and the goal of his quest. But this is also that from which he, along with all other finite creatures such as us, is blocked from comprehending. Finite can never comprehend the infinite. Even given the fullest possible revelation and an endless amount of time to absorb it. So even in eternity, when the redeemed are made to know as fully as they can know, they'll still not equal the mind of God. Because they'll still be finite and he'll still be infinite. We can only receive so much information, then we must resign it all to God, who is the infinite one, and worship and wonder and awe. A later programmatic text is in chapter 8, verses 16 and 17. This one also explicitly refers to the work of God. Gave my heart to know wisdom and to see the endeavor which has been done under the earth, on earth. I saw every work of God, verse 17. Concluded that man cannot find out the work which has been done under the sun. There's explicitly saying he's considering the work of God in his quest, and concludes man cannot find out what God has done or what his purposes are. As God's working in this world, that's still the object of scrutiny. However much man may toil in seeking, he cannot find it out. God's ordering of earthly events, his purposes behind them, are not open to human access. The mystery remains. There's another string of texts scattered throughout Ecclesiastes that I call the enjoyment of life texts. These are positive conclusions reached by Kohelet. Good examples found in chapter 2, verses 24 and 25. That's the first of these. Positive enjoyment of life texts. 2:24. There's nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and have his soul see good in his labor. That's also I have seen is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment outside of him? For to a man who is good before him, he has given wisdom and knowledge and gladness. So there's a positive conclusion. We cannot know the plans of God. We can't know the purposes of God and their details. We don't know why my mother died at age 72 of Lou Gehrig's disease. My father outlived her by 20 years. Can't answer questions like that, except it's in the hands of God. But in the meantime, God gives us gifts and he encourages us to enjoy them. Participate fully in those gifts and take them from his hand and enjoy them. They usually are the simple pleasures of daily life. There's a whole string of these positive enjoyment of life texts. We'll look at all of them. Chapter 3, verses 12 and 13. I know there's nothing better for them than to be glad and do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks and sees good in all he does, his labor, this is from the gifts of God. And there's a positive enjoyment of life text continue throughout the book. There are many more. They're listed in the outline of the handout. What then is the purpose of this book? The purpose of the entire book of Ecclesiastes has been well stated by Old Testament scholar Edward J. Young, who I quoted earlier. He says the book's purpose is to provide, quote, practical directions to the God-fearing soul for his guidance through this life. The purpose of the book is to give practical suggestions for how to navigate life in this world while not understanding God's purposes in everything that happens. Young later says, God alone can give life meaning. I think we could tweak that a little bit and say, it's the plan of God which assigns meaning to human life and the events of this world. That plan we cannot know in detail. The full knowledge of the plan of God alone can give humans complete information about life's meaning. This is Kohelet's quest to find this out. Such full knowledge is the domain of God alone. Only the infinite mind of God can comprehend the plan of God of all things, the scheme of things. Humans will have to be contented with the awareness of that limitation. And the final analysis boils down to a matter of trust. It's a matter of faith. I defined faith a few weeks ago as belief based on testimony. In this case, the testimony of God. He says he's got everything worked out. He's got the plan of the world to its end. So we trust what he says and try to enjoy what he gives us. Another purpose of Ecclesiastes is to encourage people to find enjoyment in what they'll really be able to enjoy. Then what to really give life meaning. This is from Matthew Poole, commentator of the 17th century, Puritan commentator. Poole says, the design and business of the book is to describe man's true happiness and the way leading to it, which he does both negatively and positively, negatively asserting and proving that man's happiness is not to be found either in secular wisdom or in sensual pleasures or in worldly greatness and glory or in abundance of riches or in vain profession of religion. Positively, showing that it is to lie to be had only in the fear of God, obedience to his law, which alone can give man contented and cheerful enjoyment of present comforts, assurance of future and lasting happiness. So secondary purpose of the book is to tell humans how they can live joyful, contented lives in the present, in the midst of a world which is apparently disorderly. Just looks disorderly. God has a purpose behind everything that happens. The purpose is not known to us, but we can be assured that purpose is there and it's for good for his people. I think there are at least three implications I would draw to a close today. As we desire godly knowledge, let us beware lest we approach too closely to the sin of Adam and Eve. What Adam and Eve want? They wanted godlike knowledge. They were forbidden to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Satan said, if you eat from this tree, you'll be like God. You'll know. You'll know. That's seeking knowledge which is forbidden them. Longing for knowledge like God's knowledge is what led them to disobey God. Thus they began the experience of knowledge of good and evil by participating in the evil. Not what they intended, I think. Even in eternity, when we are granted much greater knowledge than we have now, God's knowledge will infinitely surpass ours because our minds will remain finite. We creatures will remain finite, limited. We must be contented with that limitation or we'll never be contented with God. Second implication, as we make our way through the wreckage of this world, let's remember that some of the richest blessings of God are to be found in simple, ordinary, daily joys of life. Being with spouse and children, enjoying our food and meals together by God's provision and enablement. Finding joy in the accomplishment of our daily work and tasks. Finding delight in God himself and his goodness toward us. This will be emphasized over and over again by Koheleth as he continues through the book. Thirdly, it seems that the entirety of Ecclesiastes turned out to be an illustrative footnote to Deuteronomy 29:29, which Landon expounded upon earlier. Deuteronomy 29:29 says, the secret things belong to Jehovah our God, but the things that are revealed belong to us, to our children forever, that we may do the words of this law. Long ago I learned a lesson which is easier to say than to do. Obey God and let him take care of the results. Obey God and let him take care of the results. We don't know what his purposes are. We can't fathom the deep things in the mind of God. seems to be what Moses is saying. God has his secrets. You have to be contented with that. Just obey him. That's where Kohelet ends up in 12:13 of this book. How does Ecclesiastes end? The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep his commandments, because that is the end of the matter for all mankind. For God will bring every work into judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it's good or evil. There's where Kohelet lands. I think it's a coherent outlook. I think the book hangs together. That's been denied by many expositors as argument. I've tried to lay out the argument as briefly as possible today. If you think it worthwhile, we can continue this journey through Ecclesiastes. If not, I'd be happy to step aside. I'd solicit your response. Let's pray. Father, thank you for your care for us, for providing this book which addresses and answers so many of our questions, but leaves unanswered many more questions. But those we cannot answer ourselves, we need to leave them in your hands. Know that someday we'll see more clearly. We'll be contented with your purposes eternally. You give us contentment now and ability to enjoy what you give to us day by day. Continue to guide us and uphold us and help us to walk in faith through this world. In Jesus' name, amen.